Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. My guest today is Luke Hoekstra, who's the executive director of the Kings River Land Trust. In this conversation, we break down why the Kings River is considered one of the valley's most volatile waterways, looking at seasonal flows, strainers, flood years, and the massive differences between the Kings and San Joaquin. We explore a number of topics, including the three main tributaries, the Pine Flat Dam, and how the river once supported salmon runs all the way to the Pacific. We also explore irrigation districts and water authorities, how groundwater recharge fits in the bigger picture, and what flood preparation realistically looks like for the valley. Then, Luke walks us through how land trusts work, what conservation easements are, how they protect farmland and ranch land, and how these agreements balance agricultural production, wildlife habitat, and climate resilience. We also talk about recreation and environmental psychology, the challenges of stewarding landscapes that are always changing, the politics of river restoration, and the feasibility of bringing back salmon to the San Joaquin. Finally, Luke shares the King River Land Trust vision for the next 5 years, including easement projects, partnerships, and long-term protections along the river corridor. This was a fantastic conversation, and I learned so much. Let's go meet Luke Hoekstra.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best!
Luke, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Where do I like to eat in Fresno? That's one of the things that's great about Fresno. There's so many options, right? So if I had to narrow it down for fine dining.
Maybe lunch and dinner. Give us a lunch and dinner.
Lunch and dinner. For dinner, I love the Limelight. It's just a fantastic food over there. And for lunch, I have to say that Mad Duck is probably my preferred eatery.
Yeah. What do you like at Mad Duck? I often get overwhelmed by the scope of the menu. What's your kind of lane there?
I have to admit, there's a lot, many delicious things on the menu that I would love to indulge in at lunchtime, but so I don't get into a carb comatose, I try to stick to the Cobb salad that they have over there.
Oh yeah. That's honestly something that I've, since moving here from Southern California, where we're replete with salads, there's not a lot of like good big salad places, or some places will have them, but like a place that is known as I want a hearty salad for lunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I used to, around the corner from my old apartment in Pasadena, there was like a Tender Greens. And so I could just walk over there and get like a big salad and that, and feel good about my lunch, but also be fueled through my day. And I don't know if maybe I'm just looking in the wrong place. I don't feel like there's a lot of big salad places.
Yeah. I've heard Heirloom can be a good salad place.
Oh yeah.
I haven't been there. I know that's pretty popular for lunch, but yeah, I agree. There should be more salad specialty places.
Yeah.
I would patron those.
Yeah. What about Limelight? What do you like to order there?
I love the steaks there, but I do have to say that the sea bass is incredibly good. So as long as it's being sourced from a sustainable fishery, then I'm okay with that, which they ensure me it is. But it's my favorite fish in the world is sea bass.
Oh, I don't think I've ever had sea bass.
Oh,
what's it similar to for us normies that haven't ventured down that road?
Similar to, I'm going to give you another obscure one, so I don't know if you can relate to this, but monkfish. Oh. So it's a light and very flaky fish that is just spectacular in flavor. It's hard to liken it to anything else. Maybe the closest thing after that would be maybe cod.
Okay. Yeah. I've had some cod. Okay. Yeah. Like a light, flakier fish.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Awesome.
What about yourself?
Where do I like to eat in Fresno?
Yeah. Where do you like to eat?
Oh yeah. You're the first guest in a long time to turn the tables. Yeah. There's many places I like to eat. I live in the kind of Fresno High neighborhood. So I waddle down to Modo quite a bit and get salads and sandwiches. And I recently tried Sabor for the first time. It's like a high-end Mexican restaurant in the kind of that like little Bluffs strip mall there with the GB3.
Okay.
And I spent way too much money, but I had a great time and the food was incredible. So I'm excited to go back there because I just barely have tapped into the menu. But I had an excellent jalapeno margarita and some like beautiful braised meat on tortilla chips. It's a really incredible restaurant. And I know it's getting some attention, but it was off my radar until recently. So I'm very excited to go back as soon as I can.
Good. The reason I ask is I'm always looking for new recommendations. So I will definitely, that's a new one to me. I will try out Sabor.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump into the Kings River. We're going to start with kind of a big picture question. The Kings River has this reputation of being volatile and dangerous. Is that reputation warranted?
At certain times of the year? Yeah. It absolutely is. There are many multiple drownings per year on the Kings River. It's not like the San Joaquin. The San Joaquin has a very low CFS, cubic feet per second release from Bryant Dam at parts of the year. For the Kings River, it's vastly higher. We're talking the San Joaquin can be maybe less than 1,000 CFS, where you can get up from the Kings River during spring runoff to 60,000 CFS. And that's not even talking about when it floods. That's just normal releases. And the other thing too is that there's a significant amount of overgrowth from the sides of the river. You call them strainers, right? And so I was recently on the river with a gentleman who's has a old Kings, or not Kings Canyon, Grand Canyon whitewater rafting boat, and has a mounted motor on it. We were doing it some of the stretches between Annandale Bridge down to Reedley, and I could not believe how many inner tubes and rafts that I saw caught underneath those strainers. But there are, during certain parts of the year when the releases finally get scaled back, there could be some fantastic boating sections of the Kings River. So it's really important to choose the time of year that you're going.
I know California has some of the most dangerous and wild whitewater rafting. I spent the latter half of my childhood in Bakersfield, and the Kern River can just get absolutely crazy in the canyon. Can you describe for people, because I don't know if people understand like how crazy the gradient is for the Kings River, that kind of like 13,000 foot span of the river. Can you describe like that for people to give people a perspective on the how wild and long the river gradient is?
I'm not an expert on that, on the topography of it, so I really can't speak to that. But it can be very dangerous, and it's a very intense and steep run that the river makes, as you said.
So there are three forks that make up the Kings River. And what does that mean exactly in terms of forks?
So they're all tributaries, right? There's waters running out of the Sierras and out of Sequoia National Park, and coming from different areas, it's funneling down into one main channel, right? So a fork is a tributary that's providing, it's coming out of the headwaters from in high Sierras, all funneling down into the main channel.
And so in the 50s, they installed the Pine Flat Dam. Do we have a sense of what the river was like before that in terms, I know that the Tulare Lake had already disappeared by that point in a lot of ways, but do we have a sense of how big the river was prior to the installation of the dam?
The only thing that I think I can really speak to on that, because I'm not an expert in the history of the Kings River, I'll be honest with you, but I can tell you that at one point the Kings River did flow out to the Pacific Ocean. That it conjoined with the San Joaquin River downstream, and at one point it supported anadromous fish, so fish that migrate from the ocean upriver to spawn, right? So we used to have salmon actually in the Kings River, so that gives you these days. The river basically goes dry out near Mendota. You saw it 2023 during the big flood. It actually dumped into the old Tulare Lake bed, and we had a huge flood out there. But
The lake came back.
the lake came back. The year the lake came back.
I remember I did a podcast with my history show with this famous environmental historian, Donald Worcester, who has a book called Rivers of Empire, and it talks about, changing landscapes. And I remember him at towards the end of the podcast, quite old guy, I think he's in his 80s, and he said something like, that the rivers, you cannot ultimately stop them. They're going to do what they want to do. And not anthropomorphizing the rivers necessarily, but just saying whatever human attempts to stop or alter their course will eventually be corrected by nature. And I remember we had this conversation, I think in 2022. And so the next year was that climactic event. And I just remember that line that he said, and just thinking about the hubris sometimes that we think we can control nature in that way. And I'm sure you have those kinds of conversations with folks, given conservation and preservation and these discussions about what we can actually control. So what do the, because I know there's a lot of irrigation ditches and canals along the riverbed, along the valley floor. What does that do to the river exactly?
It diverts most of the water from out of the main channel. So it's so much of the King Rivers is diverted to our farms and ranches, which it needs to be. We are the breadbasket of the world. And this is some of the most fertile soil, not only in the nation, but in our state as well. Diversion of water from the channel, though, it does have negative environmental impacts, as well as not allowing for flooding. It scours the riverbed. So if you have anadromous fish, they need that scouring to wash the silt away. So they have clean gravel beds to spawn in. In our case, we don't have an anadromous fish in the river that are coming up from the Pacific Ocean. So it's basically more of a moot point. It's enough water to support natural and native species of fish in our fishery. But we also divert a ton of water from the Kings River for drinking water too. The Kings River supplies much of the drinking water for Fresno and Clovis and many of the communities going down to Kingsburg, all the way down to Stratford, way down in the south, and out to Mendota as well.
Okay. How prepared is the Kings River for flooding in terms of like impacts to human infrastructure? In those flood years when we get a surplus of water, where does that water go?
Yeah, so when we have a surplus of water, you saw what happened in 2023. It reformed.
Yeah, maybe hilarious. Like a year where there's water, but not like an event of that size. Just a year where we have maybe an excess of rain, but not flooding necessarily.
Yeah, so a normal year. So it's being diverted to our farms, ranches, and our cities, obviously. It's getting recharged into the groundwater, which is critically important because we need that as well. But the Kings River Water District and Water Authority, they manage it incredibly well. Thank gosh we don't have more urban development along the river than we do, because that would create much more economic damage to homes. The farmlands and ranch lands and open space lands that we have along the Kings River, they actually, with all of the vegetation, help to control a lot of the, and allow the water to seep onto the land where it gets recharged into the groundwater. It doesn't damage homes that are along it, that are more typical for the San Joaquin River. We have many more homes along the San Joaquin River. And if that were to flood, we would see really an economic catastrophe. So as part of our goal, as we work in collaboration with the King River Conservation District, King River Water Authority, our missions are very aligned in that, is that these lands, we want to see them stay in agriculture and ranching, so that when we do have those excess water years, the water can spill out fairly undamaging to most of the lands and allow that water to sit there and seep and recharge the groundwater table.
One thing I often don't understand is how is the governance of irrigation districts, like how they make decisions. It feels opaque to me as someone that's not in that world. Can you help us understand like what their role is with the Kings River, how they make decisions and what those decisions, what are they trying to accomplish?
Yeah, I'm not an expert in water districts, I'll be honest with you there. But their role is, water in the West is a incredibly valuable commodity, right? So if someone's got to figure out, how do we take this incredibly valuable resource and allocate that out in a fair and hopefully in a beneficial way that maximizes the resource of it for as many people and for the environment as possible. So their role is to allocate that water, you know, to how much is going to go to farms and ranches, how much is going to go to cities, how much is going to be left in the river for natural purposes for our fishery, right? Just to support the riparian lands, the trees, the grasses, the shrubbery along the banks that provide critical wildlife habitat.
Yeah.
So it's an incredibly challenging job, one that I would not want to have to take on myself. We have also GSAs, groundwater sustainability agencies, that are managing. So these water districts are managing the surface water, but then you have these GSAs, groundwater sustainability agencies, that are managing the water table itself. So it's very complicated. There's a lot of hands in the pot, and there's a lot of opinions on what should be done and what shouldn't be done. And our role is trying to support them in making sound decisions as possible. But our greater focus are the lands that the Kings River supports. So not only directly along its banks, but all of the lands that are supported by the Kings River through its groundwater as well.
Great. Let's jump into the land trust now. We've talked about the Kings River, and I want to understand structurally and what the focus is. Broadly speaking, can you just give us what the purpose and function of a river land trust is? Maybe in the kind of abstract sense, and then we'll ground down into the Kings River land trust.
Sure. Yeah. So there's in California, let me back out. So nationally, there are thousands of land trusts across the country. In California, I think we are somewhere around 170 different land trusts. And the function of a land trust is to basically work as a support agency along state agencies that are responsible for protecting natural resources, right? So we're all nonprofit organizations. We're not state agencies. We're private organizations. But we partner with state agencies by writing grants and pursuing funding from them to basically extend the impact of their work by working directly with landowners and public agencies ourselves. Specifically, and more, I should say, more specifically, we mostly work directly with private landowners to try to help them conserve their lands from being converted to urban development. So that's our farmlands, our ranch lands, and our open space lands that provide wildlife habitat. We do that, all of us land trusts, by doing one of two things. We either work with the landowner to purchase the property outright to protect it for farmland, ranching, or wildlife habitat, or, and that's called the fee simple, you're buying the actual title of the property. More commonly, though, most of us land trusts engage in what we call conservation easements. And we do that by working with the landowner to voluntarily either have them donate just the development rights or to purchase the development rights on the property. What that does is it ensures that legally that land can never be used for any purposes other than ranching, farming, and being used for wildlife habitat. The property owner retains all of the other rights of the property. So they own the property. They can continue to do whatever they're doing on the land, their agricultural production. They can get liens on the property, loans on the property. They can sell the property, pass it down to their heirs. And the beautiful part about it is that unlike a state agency or a federal agency that might be seen overbearing on their personal rights, you know, what they can do on their property, we just come in once a year and just ensure that they are continuing to do what they said they were going to do. The deed of conservation easement establishes what they're going to do on the property, what's going to be allowed going forward. We come in and just make sure that they haven't developed some sort of apartment complex.
Yeah,
that
was there's not a high rise on the river. Agreement.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Can you distinguish, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, there is some variance between land trusts in terms of their goals. And I think it would be helpful, given that I've had Sharon Weaver, who runs the San Joaquin River Parkway Trust, distinguish like how goals can differ in land trusts and why that is.
Yeah, there are land trusts that are more focused on just wildlife habitat. And I would say that's the case with the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust. They're focused on providing wildlife habitat, but also recreational access to the river, right? They are involved to some extent in protecting agricultural lands along the San Joaquin River. But other land trusts like ours are not as focused on recreation. We are more focused on protecting the ranch lands and farmlands and less so to protecting wildlife habitat. That's critically important to us, but
can I ask you a question about the recreation? Yeah. I know it's not something you guys do, but I know in your career that you've done different kind of recreation-focused learning opportunities and your work in Santa Cruz, and we'll talk about that in a second. But
You did your research on me.
Yeah, I'm curious. Do you think recreation access can lead to environmental awareness? Or do you think those things are separate or orthogonal, to use a fancy term, of like totally unrelated? If you open up areas along the San Joaquin, for example, Lost Lake Campground, for example, people are going to come there to do barbecues, but are they necessarily going to be thinking about, oh, I need to protect this space? Or is that just unrelated? What's your kind of big picture thoughts with recreation and environmental awareness and how they intersect?
Yeah, that's, I started my career out in environmental education and recreation, and that is the cornerstone of why I got involved in this subject matter, is because when people engage in outdoor recreation, they not only identify it as a critical resource to allow them to relax, enjoy in themselves, unwind, to decompress, to escape urban environments, right? But it creates an emotional attachment. When I go to this place, I feel this way. And that becomes incredibly important to me. I can't create that feeling in an urban setting. I have to be out here amongst the trees, the river, these open spaces in order for me to be able to have that emotional experience. And it creates a bond that in order for me to have this, it gives me this. And I'm not saying that necessarily this is happening on a conscious level, but I believe it's happening on mostly a subconscious level. This land gives me this opportunity. And so when I hear it being threatened, I want to protect it. Just like any relationship. If I feel this way and I'm communicating or having a relationship with this person, that's valuable to me. They make me feel this way, and I want to protect that person. So I believe that it's the very same context with recreational opportunities in open space areas.
Yeah, I know that we've been having some discussion about this because during the shutdown, I've heard that Yosemite turned into Disney World and people running around, and there was like huge groups
That's
of
right.
people on meadows taking like massive group photos and stomping on natural grasses and wildlife. And so I
Yeah.
often think about how to balance like recreation and conservation. And it seems like there needs to be structure, but also freedom. And I don't know how you find that necessarily or help people because they don't have the awareness of, I need to be careful here.
Yeah. Usually for me, it comes down to what is that land supporting, whether it's flora or fauna, so animals or plants. If it's like, for instance, out in Joshua Tree National Park, a certain areas that have cryptobiotic soil. So that's nitrogen fixing plants that are critically important. This is the one of the few only ways that soil or sands out there are going to be able to support plant life out there. So that's why they create trails. They want to funnel everybody down a certain trail, not everybody just wandering off wherever you go. So it depends what the land's supporting. But I think that we've done a good job, in the past 50, 60 years of creating multiple uses for lands. And so I'm very much in favor of that. Some lands, we've got to be more sensitive. Maybe we just allow hiking on that particular land. Other lands may not be as sensitive. The resources that are on that land are in abundance enough where we can allow maybe off-road vehicles to be having for folks to have a good time. There is a slew of things that people like to do in nature, right? And we want to support that. The right place, it's important to support the right activity.
Yeah, and we're part of nature too. I always remind people, like, I think there's this idea nature is outside of us, but we're part of it. But I also think it's understanding, just like understanding a human's capacity, you got to understand a landscape's capacity. What can it support? What can it realistically house? Can it? Some places, it's not good for there to be 50 Airstreams parked in the middle of an area stomping on endangered wildlife. And then there are some places where you can just let people run and pull out their quads and do whatever. And so I think from my point of view, it feels like you need experts to guide, but then you got to give people simple rules they can follow so you don't create conflict. Okay, one more question before we move to my favorite section here, which is overrated versus underrated. I wanted to ask you, because I was reading about tax incentives for farmers to donate land. How motivating is that? Or do you think it's more of a cultural thing of them wanting to protect something that they value because they live on the land and appreciate it? Is tax incentives really, is that a big motivator for people?
Yeah, it is. I think, as you said, though, I think more important for these folks, the folks that partner with us, they for like ranchers and farmers, the average rancher or farmer in California is in their mid-50s to 60s right now. The next generation, for the most part, I shouldn't say for the most part, but in many cases, are not interested in going into farming. And so that you have so many farms and ranches nationally and throughout our state that are their legacy lands. And that's part of the landowner's legacy. That's their family history. Maybe they've been on there for generations and they don't want to see that farm or ranch be converted just because their children or grandchildren are not interested in continuing in agricultural production. So I would say that's oftentimes the top motivator for most of the landowners we work with. But certainly there are other financial implications, like you mentioned, the tax deduction possibilities. But also, in most of the cases that our landowners that we work with, we're purchasing the development rights on their property. So it's enabling them to get some cash flow now. It's very challenging to be in ranching, and especially farming right now. Due to the trade war, you've got higher production costs, we've got labor shortages, we also just fuel prices and trying to transport your produce to market, etc. So it's a cash flow that they can receive by selling the development rights can be critically important and vital to them to even be able to continue, conceive me, continue the agricultural production on the property. We also have folks, though, too, that may be interested. As I mentioned, a lot of the farmers and ranchers in their 50s or 60s, they're getting ready to retire. And that cash flow can allow them to possibly retire early or even retire at all.
Yeah. I have some follow-up questions, but we're gonna jump into overrated versus underrated. I'm gonna throw a bunch of things at you, some from your
Okay.
background and some of interest to you that I know about. And I want you to just tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. Feel free to pass on any of these. We're gonna start with one that I think you know about. The Delta Breeze. Is that over or underrated?
The actual breeze
Yeah,
itself,
the Delta Breeze.
the
It's
Delta Breeze.
often talked about. I lived in Stockton for a year, so I got to experience it. I was expecting something a little cooler. It was fine. It was a good breeze, but I don't know. How do you feel about
I'll say two things about it. It depends on where you live.
it? Okay.
I used to live in Sacramento recently for about 4 years, and so it is underrated in Sacramento because it's fantastic. It clears the air out and it brings this beautiful breeze on hot summer days. That coupled with all the trees in that beautiful city, it creates a fantastic living environment. It's overrated if you live in the North Valley or South Valley. I grew up in Redding and Red Bluff, which is at the north end of the valley, and I live down here, obviously in Fresno, we close. But down here, it pushes all that smog out of the city and out of Sacramento and funnels them both ways, right north and south, down to those areas. So not only does that bring all that smog down, but it creates that immersion layer keeps all the heat in, and so I would say
I
that
did not
in that
realize
case,
that. I did not connect those dots that when I was living in Stockton for a year, as I was being cooled, I was smogging my neighbors up. That's sad and funny. All right, next one, blast from the past. Victorian homes in Old Town Eureka.
Victorian homes, and I would say that those are underrated.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I saw them a few years ago and I was blown away. And I don't know how close to Humboldt State they are, but it just, because I lived in San Francisco and there were beautiful Victorian homes there. But I was blown away by the existence of this kind of neighborhood district area in Old Town Eureka.
Oh, it's 7 miles away. Humboldt State is 7 miles away from Eureka. I know because I used to ride my bike down to Eureka. But when you get down there, it's like you mentioned in San Francisco, much like a natural landscape, there are certain things that just add incredible beauty. Like you could walk out onto a grassland, right? And for some, that may be beautiful. For others, it may be a little boring. But when you get into places like Sequoias, right? Or you get into to Redwoods, or you get into seeing the rocks at Joshua National Park, those things add such variety. And I think that's critically important that we need that stimulus, not only in our urban environments, but we need that, or excuse me, in our natural environments, but we need that in our urban environments as well, to be able to have things around you that are a beauty that make this world in our urban settings a little more tolerable. I think that Victorian homes in Eureka, San Francisco, do just that, especially in the world where it seems that our housing has become so much more less ornamental, less detailed. It can be a little visually monotonous. So, underrated.
Okay. Next one. Being a transplant to Fresno, you and I share this. Do you think it's over or underrated?
I think it is slightly overrated. I grew up in Northern California. It's surrounded by beautiful mountains, rivers. We have rivers here as well, but it's the mountains are right next to you. So in the valley, we have mountains. We have the coastal mountains out to the west. We have the Sierras over to our east, obviously, but everything's far away. It can feel like you're out of touch, a little more out of touch with nature. So that's why I say that it's slightly overrated. I like to be a little more immersed into mountainous landscapes being right next to us.
Okay. What's the best state park to hike in Santa Cruz?
Best state park in Santa Cruz. I really love Natural Bridges,
Yeah.
right at the ocean there, because you get to have the ocean, obviously, but it doesn't have all the as many of the crowds. You have a chance where you can escape to yourself, you can explore the tide pools. And sometimes in nature, I don't, or along the beach, I don't want to hear the screaming of the boardwalk all day long. You're far enough away at Natural Bridges where you can actually immerse yourself into nature and get some alone time.
Okay. I know you like wine tasting. Do you think Paso Robles wine tasting is over or underrated? As someone from Northern California, there tends to be a bias towards Sonoma, Napa. I'm curious.
I used to not hold the highest opinion of it, but then I realized how much have you really explored it? And
Okay.
so I've spent a lot of time in Napa, excuse me, in Sonoma. My wife and I love to go wine tasting and wine touring. But the more I started to dig into Paso Robles wineries and take trips over there, probably about 5, 6 years ago, I became incredibly impressed. I'm a big Zinfandel
Oh, yeah. White. I lived in the Stockton-Lodi area, so I became obsessed with Zins as well that year.
Yeah.
Not
Yeah,
that
exactly.
necessarily the big jammy ones, but I like, and that's, it's gotten more sophisticated. I actually just went this past weekend to Taste in Lodi, and I went to the kind of the usual suspects. I went to Oak Farm, I went to M2, which is one of my favorites. And yeah, they rolled out some Zins for me that was like just
Yeah.
mind expanding. I was like, people are doing incredible things with grapes these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's
Yeah.
your, do you have favorite wineries in Paso Robles to go to?
I would say a favorite one. Now, the more I'm exploring, these my list kept growing. I started out thinking that, and my list just kept growing. And I love to get into the boutique wineries over there. Those are
Yes.
my favorite. You have some beautiful large production wineries over there, but I love to be able to talk wine with the pours. Sometimes you get to talk to the winemaker themselves.
Oh, that's
So,
the best when they come out
yeah.
because inevitably they start opening extra bottles and you're like,
Yes.
I'm not moving
Yes.
anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay, two more. Electric mountain bikes. Do you need some power on your mountain bikes or old school?
Yeah. For me, I'm old school. I liken it to rock climbing. I rock climbed for years when I was younger, anyhow. And there's two types of rock climbing. There's trad climbing, which just stands for traditional climbing, or we call it sport climbing, which is you're using bolts, right, and a lot of equipment to get you up the rock. So mountain biking is very similar. I'm old school. I'm trying to use it not only to immerse myself in nature, but to stay in shape as well. But I do advocate for electric mountain bikes because many folks just aren't in good enough shape. Maybe they've got injuries, maybe it's age. And I don't want to see them prevented from getting into nature and enjoying mountain biking.
Yeah.
I like there to be as many gateway drugs to nature as we can possibly provide for folks. And I'm all in favor of electric mountain bikes as well.
Yeah, I think I did that once and I almost thought I had too much power because I got going so fast. Because you'll have those downhills and you'll forget to like peel back and you're just like, oh wow, I am a bullet going straight to the end of this trail. All
Yeah.
right, last one. What is the most underrated hiking trail in the area for you?
Underrated hiking trail in the area. My favorite hiking trail is just above Mono Hot Springs.
Okay.
It's the Bear Creek Diversion. And I've done that goes all the way up to Mount Hilgard at the very top. And I love backpacking up there. That is a spectacular trail with incredible access to waterfalls and swimming pools. And then you can get to the High Sierra above the tree line way up at Mount Hilgard, about 11,000 feet. Not only backpacked there many times, but I helped a friend of mine who's getting his PhD and he was doing studies on monkey flowers. And we had a bunch of plots up there. So we would go up and spend days planting seeds, but measuring the growth rate of monkey flowers up there. We got to do that above the tree line. And the views from the top up there are just glorious.
Sounds
Absolutely
amazing.
glorious.
I haven't done that. I'm going to add that to my list. I always like to get some trails that where I can, me and my wife can go up there and go on a little hike. We try to find ones that aren't too vigorous, but it can be
Right.
a leisurely walk. And so it depends,
Yeah.
I guess, what your definition
I'll warn you, Bear Creek starts out nice and then it gets mean really quick.
is. As a lot of trails do. That makes
Yeah.
sense. So let's talk about stewardship for a little bit here. How do you understand stewardship in the balance, because we were talking about overgrowth and inner tubes being stuck along the river. How do you think about balancing trying to maintain something with also allowing it to change? So I'm thinking about this in the context of climate change, for example.
Right.
And when we put up the Pine Flat Dam, for instance, that changed the type of fish that are in the river. It tends to be warmer fish because they can't access to the higher elevation. So for
Right.
you, conceptually, how do you think about that balance between stabilizing something and then allowing it to change?
I'll throw two words at you. Stewardship to me is the difference. You have to make it a choice between preservation and conservation. When we're trying to preserve something, we're trying to keep it exactly as it is. We don't want any change to happen. And that's like loving something to death. It doesn't recognize like keeping your child at home, not allowing them to venture out and have social experiences, physical experiences, to put themselves at risk at times, right? So that they have chances to grow. That wouldn't be healthy for them, keep them in de home and deprive them of that experience. The same thing applies to nature. I think the more appropriate way to steward the land is to focus on conservation, to recognize that the land is evolving all the time. It needs to, that we need a biodiversity. They are the building blocks of evolution, right? The evolvement, and they are the tools of natural selection and herald in the changes that are natural. They're healthy for the land. We want the land to continue to evolve. So we have to factor in those. What activities, what land management do we need to engage in that allows the land to continue to evolve and change and thrive? But like you said earlier, we are humans. We are part of nature as well. We have needs, and we have to manage the land and steward it for our needs as well.
Yeah. So a few years ago, there was a fascinating book that I read. There's those books like The Sixth Extinction that talk about just the kind of mass extinction events that are going on right now. But you don't often hear about the explosion of new species. And there was a book that came out a few years ago that discussed just like sparrows, for example. Our urban infrastructure has exploded the variety of them. And right. we don't, they're not polar bears or not, they're not large mammals. Mm-hmm. I don't think we consider them as much as we might consider if polar bears were to go to extinct, but they're animals right. too. And so right. I think oftentimes we get stuck on what was and not see what's emerging. And I right. think that's one of the biggest challenges of the environmental movement is it's just a losing battle in a lot of ways. But it's also at the same time, I think it's something where we need to look at what is being replaced. Sorry, I'm just vamping now, but are you following what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, let's make this concrete. So I know they're trying to reintroduce salmon into the San Joaquin.
Right.
What do you think about that?
I think ideally it's beautiful, right?
Yeah.
It would be wonderful to have salmon in the river because they are salmon are an indicator species. They are a cornerstone species.
Yeah.
The river has to be incredibly healthy to support salmon, which means if it's that healthy, it's really supporting a lot of other aquatic life as well. Also, they are a food supply for many of the predators. So not only raptors, but you've got raccoons, you've got river otters, et cetera. I can go on and on with the things that consume salmon in the river. But I can tell you that it costs us a lot of money to try to get the river restored to a spot where it can support salmon. So I'm not saying right or wrong. I'm just saying cost benefit. I'll just speak to that rather than right or wrong. Yeah, just cost benefit. Yeah, yeah. And it's also, it requires a lot more water to be in the river, to support the salmon, to scour the riverbed like we talked about earlier, which means that there are farms and ranches downriver, especially on the west side, that are deprived of the water that they would like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything's a cost benefit.
I don't know how you feel about this. I understand at some dimension the kind of the reasoning behind a lot of those signs of stop allowing our water to run off. You just see those signs along the 99. They're political signs ultimately, but I wish it was less polarized, our discussions about this, because I want a beautiful environment. I had Ryan Jacobson on this podcast a number of years ago, and he talked about like his job is to pursue agricultural interests in the Central Valley. And he understands that's
right.
what his job is. But he also wants to live on the land, right? Mm-hmm. So he was talking about the balance between some of the externalities of agriculture mm-hmm. with also the reality that you are going to occupy this space. And so mm-hmm. I want agriculture to flourish because that's the bedrock of our economy. But I also want to enjoy the place I live. And that feels like it's missing in the kind of in these kind of discussions about balancing those two interests. And I don't know what the way out of that kind of polarization trap is. Maybe there is no way, but it's frustrating as someone that lives here.
Yeah, so much of everything's polarized these days, right? Which is really sad. But my vision for that and the balance there is that I think we need to focus more on infill development. So obviously we want to be able to enjoy our spaces, but it's like Sacramento, being from Stockton, and you've been to Sacramento many times, is doing a much better job of creating infill development. They're taking the old spaces that are dilapidated, that are not being used, and they're reinvesting into those spaces. They're creating housing developments that are much more compact. Our population is growing exponentially, right? We're up to 40 million people in California, and that's not going to stop. So we have a couple of choices. We either grow up or we grow out.
Yeah, I'm sure you have thoughts about SATA then, but we won't go down that road.
We'll get into that. We have a long history of developing outwards and sprawling outwards in Fresno County. We are the breadbasket. Again, California grows about half of our fruits, our fruits and nuts, and about we grow about half of our vegetables and three quarters of our fruits and nuts for not only for our country, but we export to about in Fresno County, over 90 countries around the world, right? We've got to protect our agricultural land. California is unique. Its climate, its soils, its water supply, the snowpack that we receive coming down out of the mountains in the summertime. These are places that are very unique around the world. And we grow crops here that just can't be grown anywhere else. So once we develop these places and when we spread out and we put houses on them and we put Walmarts and parking lots on those lands, they will never be converted back. That's a long-term decision that I think we have to take very seriously. And so, again, I advocate for, yes, we can have beautiful urban spaces, but let's do it up. Let's not do it outwards.
I love that. I want to conclude by talking about a recent project. This is something I read about on your guys' blog, that the McKill Ranch Project. Yeah, I would love to hear about how fencing help kind of balances the needs of agriculture and conservation.
So the McKill Ranch is a property that's located along the Kings River just north of Greeley. We purchased a conservation easement on that property in collaboration with Caltrans. When Caltrans expanded the Highway 180 going east, they took out a bunch of Valley Oaks and Oakland Savannah. And under CEQA laws, the California Environmental Quality Act, they were required to mitigate for that, to offset. So they partnered with us and provided funding for us to purchase a conservation easement on that property. And then we just replaced the cattle fencing on that property. That was funded by Caltrans. And the reason that we did that is that those ranch lands out there benefit from cattle grazing, because the cattle not only keep the wildfire hazard by grazing of grasses, but it also helped to control the spread of invasive species on the property as well. Without proper fencing, obviously the rancher can't do that. So by replacing the fence, it now allows him to do that. And so it's a great balance where we're having agricultural production take place on the property at the same time. It's also providing wildlife habitat adjacent to the river too.
This past year, there was a book that was published by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson called Abundance. And part of what the book was talking about in a lot of ways was reducing the layers of red tape, the duplicate environmental impact reports, all those kinds of things. How do you view that kind of move to remove some of the, quote, maybe in scare quotes, protections around projects, move all those kind of additional layers of bureaucracy? Do you think, from an environmental perspective, how do you think about that?
Yeah, we do. In one sense, I'm very proud of living in California. We have a lot of stringent laws that help to protect our open space lands, our natural space lands, which I think are critically important. They provide very vital wildlife habitat, and they protect our farmlands and ranches as well. But I think it can be a bit of overkill at times, depending on which regulation it is. It does make it very challenging to conduct business, to create new housing when we need to create new housing. And we do. We have a housing shortage in California. It can make it very challenging to farm and ranch as well in California. So I like the idea of going back and visiting, visiting our environmental laws, but I think we need to be careful not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? It's easy to get frustrated and say, let's just start tearing apart these laws and just without critical thinking, create actions that are making it very hard to go back and try to reenact that legislation later on if it's overturned in the short term.
Yeah. Let's close here by talking about what your vision is for the Kings River Lands Trust. Let's say you had green lights for the next 5 years. What would you hope the Kings River to look like?
Yeah, our goal at Kings River Land Trust is to try to conserve and protect 1,000 acres in the next 5 years. So right now we've got 80 acres in conservation easement. We're getting ready to close on another 112-acre conservation easement on a farm in Sanger. We just received another grant from the state to purchase a conservation easement on another 55 acres. So we are sprinting as much as we can right now to try to get to that 1,000-acre goal in the next 5 years. Fortunately, we are not the only land trust working in the area, so we are partnered with those organizations as well. But eventually, it would be beyond 5 years, and it's going to take longer to do that. But I would eventually like to see most of the lands that are along the Kings River and that are supported by its groundwater permanently protected to stay as ranch land, farmland, and open space lands for wildlife habitat.
Okay, fantastic. We conclude these podcasts each time with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
few books I like to recommend to listeners. I would say, grab that book right here. It's one of my favorites. If you can see this or not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think the background, it's Win Friends, right?
Yeah. How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yeah.
I think is
becoming an increasingly underrated skill. I think smartphones I see it with kids and just like simple requests to me and not knowing those kind of, I don't want to say etiquette, but like how to communicate effectively, maybe. I don't know if that's on the wane.
Yeah, no, the reason I like this book is that it's a very popular sales book and most folks read it trying to figure out, oh, I want to take away and learn tactics to be able to how to influence people. But what he focuses on is relationships and friendships, right? Yeah. Genuine relationships and friendships. And when you do that and that's your approach first, people first trust you, right? And once they trust you, they become much more open to the conversation, consideration for your needs and what you're saying as well. And so I think that's what we need to get back to, is really trying to be friendly, be conscientious, recognize we all have needs and that we're better off if we getting our needs met if we help take care of other people's needs too.
Absolutely. So if, let's say, people want to get involved with the Kings River Land Trust, how can they find out more information and are there opportunities for volunteering or things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. The easiest thing to do is to go to our website, which is kingsriverlandtrust.org. So not .com, .org. There you can find not only all the events that we have happening. So that's the first thing I would suggest. If you want to get involved with this, is come to one of our events. We have educational events that we conduct along the river, many different locations. We had a stargazing event earlier this year. We had a wildlife adventures, a hiking event. We also just like to have fun too. We just had our barbecue bash. And so folks came out and enjoyed beautiful barbecue, wine, and live music with us. That's how I would suggest that folks get involved, is join us for one of our events. The second thing is to sign up for our newsletter, because you'll receive all the information via your email. And then thirdly, we have volunteer opportunities. So if you want to get involved and become a committee member or even a board member, we would love to be able to talk to you about that. And then lastly, we encourage folks to support us. We are a nonprofit organization. We get grant funding to purchase these properties, but it doesn't fund all of our work. And so if you believe or you're inspired by what we're doing, please support us. You can do that by becoming a monthly member for a very small amount of money, right? Maybe $10, $5, $20 a month. Or if you want to become one of our more significant supporters, we would certainly love that as well. And all that can be done through our website at kingsriverlandtrust.org.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you got to pay someone to write those grant applications.
That's right.
They don't write themselves. Maybe ChatGPT will at some point, but then we'll all be doing that. Anyway, right. Luke, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you so much, too. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/FresnosBest. We'll see you next time.